Our moderator tonight is John Leonard. He is the Chair of Religious Studies at Edgewood College. So I'm going to have him come up and he will introduce the program. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome again. The Faith and Reason series is quite a production, as you could see from the brochures, the posters that have been out, and it certainly has attracted a lot of attention immediately as soon as it came out. So I'm glad to see so many people are out tonight. Our speakers tonight, as you know from the posters, are Chris Hedges and Marshall O'Nellian. Chris, as you know, the author of the book that's for sale, and several of his texts are for sale tonight, graduated from seminary at Harvard Divinity School and was foreign correspondent for nearly two decades for the New York Times and other publications. He was part of the team of reporters at the New York Times that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of global terrorism. Chris is the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, among other texts. The second speaker is Marshall O'Nellian, who is professor of physics at the UW here, born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was an Eagle Scout at 13, a U.S. Air Force officer, and has been at the UW since 1987. Marshall lives in Stoughton and is the author, along with another speaker in our series, whom you will meet in the coming weeks, of Seeking Truth, Living with Doubt. Please welcome our speakers and enjoy the evening.
Well, thank you very much. I grew up in a farm town in upstate New York, where my life and the life of my family centered on the Presbyterian Church. I prayed and sang hymns every Sunday, went to Bible school, listened to my father preach the weekly sermon, and attended seminary, as you heard, at Harvard Divinity School to be a preacher myself. America was a place where things could be better if we worked to make them better, and where our faith saved us from despair, self-righteousness, and the dangerous belief that we knew or could carry out the will of God. We were taught that those who claimed to speak for God, the self-appointed prophets who promised the kingdom of God on earth, were dangerous. We had no ability to understand God's will. We were taught we did the best we could. We trusted and had faith in the mystery, the unknown before us. We made decisions, even decisions that on the outside looked moral, well aware of the numerous motives, some good and some bad, that went into every human act. In the end, we all stood in need of forgiveness. We were all tainted by sin. None were pure. The Bible was not the literal word of God. It was not a self-help manual that could predict the future. It did not tell us how to vote, or allow us to divide the world into us and them, the righteous and the damned, the infidels and the blessed. It was a book written by a series of ancient writers, certainly fallible and at times at odds with each other, who asked the right questions and struggled with the mystery and transcendence of human existence. There was no alcohol in the manse where I grew up. Indeed, my father invested huge amounts of energy in a quixotic attempt to shut down the glass bar, the one bar in town, and railed against the drinking in the VFW hall. We did not work on the Sabbath. I never heard my father swear. But coupled with this piety was a belief that as Christians, we were called to fight for justice. My father took an early stand in the town in support of the civil rights movement, a position that was highly unpopular in rural white enclaves where Dr. Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. A veteran of World War II, he opposed the Vietnam War, telling me when I was about 12 that if the war was still being waged and I was 18 and drafted, he would go to prison with me. And to this day, I carry in my head the rather gloomy image of sitting in a jail cell with my dad. Finally, because his youngest brother was gay, he understood the pain of being a gay man in America. He worked in the latter part of his life in the gay rights movement, calling for the ordination and marriage of gays. When he found that my college had no gay and lesbian organization, he brought gay speakers to Colgate. The meetings led to gays and lesbians confiding in him that they felt uncomfortable coming out of the closet to start an open gay and lesbian organization, a problem my father swiftly solved by taking me out to lunch and informing me, although I was not gay, that I had to found it. When I went into the dining hall for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the checker behind the desk would take my card, mark off the appropriate box, and hand it back to me, saying, "Faggot." I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend. This willingness on the part of my father to take a moral stand, to accept risk and ridicule, was, he showed me, the cost of the moral life. The Bible informed his life, as it has informed mine, but it never occurred to him to treat it as the literal word of God. The writers of the book of Genesis, who wrote about the creation of the world in 6 days, knew nothing, he told us, about the process of creation. They believed the earth was flat, with rivers above and below us. They wrote that God created light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day. Genesis was not written to explain the process of creation. It was written to help explain the purpose of creation. It was written to help us grasp a spiritual truth, not a scientific or historical fact. And this purpose, this spiritual truth, is something the writers did know about. The biblical writers, at their best, understood our divided natures. They knew our internal conflicts and battles, how we could love our brother and yet hate him, the oppressive power of parents, even the best of parents, the impulses that drive us to commit violations against others, the yearning to lead a life of meaning, our fear of mortality, our struggles to deal with our uncertainty, our loneliness, our greed, our lust, our ambition, our desires to be God, as well as our moments of nobility, compassion, and courage. They knew these emotions and feelings were entangled. They understood our weaknesses and our strengths. They understood how we are often not the people we want to be or know we should be, how hard it is for us to articulate all this, and how life and creation can be as glorious and beautiful as it can be mysterious, evil, and cruel. It is why Genesis is worth reading, indeed why the Bible stands as one of the great ethical and moral documents of our age. The biblical writers have helped shape and define Western civilization. Not to know the Bible, in some ways, is to be illiterate, to neglect the very roots of much that has informed our philosophy, art, literature, poetry, and music. It is to fall into a dangerous provincialism, as myopic and narrow as that embraced by those who say everything in the Bible is literally true and we do not need any other kind of intellectual inquiry. Doubt and belief are not, as biblical literalists claim, incompatible. Those who act without doubt are frightening. There lives more faith in honest doubt, Tennyson wrote, believe me, than in half the creeds. This was my faith. It is a pretty good summary of my faith today. God is inscrutable, mysterious, unknowable. We do not know or understand what life is about, what it means, why we are here, or what will happen to us after our brief sojourn on the planet ends. We are saved in the end by faith. Faith and trust that life is not meaningless and random, that there is a purpose to human existence, and that in the midst of this morally neutral universe, acts of compassion and blind human kindness, especially to those labeled our enemies and strangers, sustain the divine spark, which is love. These small acts of compassion have a power that lives after us. They are deeply subversive to all totalitarian creeds, which seek to thwart love outside of the small circle of believers. Through these acts, we recognize and affirm the humanity of the other, of the stranger, an affirmation which undermines the absolute control of totalitarian masters. Those who struggle to live the moral life and are able to sacrifice for others, even at great cost, stand as constant witnesses in our lives to this love, even long after they are gone. In the Gospels, this is called resurrection. Faith presupposes that we cannot know. We can never know. Those who claim to know what life means play God. These false prophets, clutching the cross and the Bible, offer, like Mephistopheles, to lead us back to a mythical paradise and an impossible, unachievable happiness and security, at once seductive and empowering. These self-appointed prophets, who saturate the airwaves, ask us to hand over moral choice and responsibility to them. They will tell us what is right and wrong in the eyes of God. They will tell us how to act, how to live. And in this process, they elevate themselves above us. They remove the anxiety of moral choice, the fundamental anxiety of human existence. This is part of their attraction. They give us the rules by which we live. But once we hand over this anxiety and accept their authority, we become enslaved. They become idols, and idols, as the Bible never ceases to tell us, destroy us. This is the battle underway in America. Should those who have raised themselves to the status of idols, men who preach that they know the will of God and can build a Christian America, achieve the power they seek, America as we know it will be destroyed. I saw enough of the world over the past 2 decades, for although I graduated from seminary, I was not ordained, and worked in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans as a foreign correspondent, to grasp that men and women of great moral probity and courage arise in all cultures, all nations, and all religions, to challenge the oppressor and fight for the oppressed. I also saw how the dominant religions of these nations were often twisted and distorted by totalitarian movements, turned into civic religions, where the goals of the movement or the state became the goals of the divine. The wars I covered were often fought in the name of one god or another. All, in fact, mocked the faith they purported to defend. America and the Christian religion have no monopoly on goodness or saintliness. God has not chosen us as a people above others. Our religious beliefs are as flawed and imperfect as all religious beliefs. But the best of American democracy and the best of the Christian religion embodies important values, values such as compassion, tolerance, a belief in justice and equality. America is a nation where all have a voice and a say in how they live and how they are governed. That we have never fully achieved these goals is a given, but our health as a country is determined by our steadfastness in striving to attain them. These values, democratic and Christian, are being dismantled by a movement that has appropriated the language and moral arguments from evangelicals, fundamentalists, and American patriots. But they are distinct from traditional evangelicals and fundamentalists, and that they seek to use religion as a route to political power. This movement, properly called Dominionism or Christian Reconstructionism, is a radical mutation. It argues that American Christians have been mandated by God to rule, and it has many similarities with classical fascist movements. What the desperate sects that make up this movement share is an obsession with political power. Dominionists preach that Jesus has called on them to build the kingdom of God on earth. America becomes, in this militant biblicalism, an agent of God, and all political and intellectual opponents of America's Christian leaders are viewed, quite simply, as agents of Satan. Under Christian dominion, America will no longer be a sinful and fallen nation, but one in which the Ten Commandments will form the basis of our legal system. Aside from its proselytizing, the federal government will be reduced to the protection of property rights and homeland security. Some dominionists would further require all citizens to pay tithes to church organizations empowered by the government to run our social welfare agencies, and a number of influential figures advocate the death penalty for a host of moral crimes, including adultery, sodomy, apostasy, blasphemy, and witchcraft. The only legitimate voices in this state will be Christian. All others will be silenced. The engine that drives the radical Christian right in the United States, the most dangerous mass movement in American history, is not religiosity, but despair. It is a movement built on the growing personal and economic despair of tens of millions of Americans who have watched helplessly as their communities were plunged into poverty by the flight of manufacturing jobs, their families and neighborhoods torn apart by neglect and indifference, and who eventually lost hope that America was a place where they had a future. This despair crosses economic boundaries, of course, enveloping many in the middle class who live trapped in huge, soulless exurbs, where lacking any form of community rituals or centers, they also feel deeply isolated, vulnerable, and lonely. Those in despair are the most easily manipulated by demagogues who promise a fantastic utopia, whether it is a workers' paradise, fraternité, égalité, liberté, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. Those in despair search desperately for a solution, the warm embrace of a community to replace the one they lost, a sense of purpose and meaning, the assurance they are protected, loved, worthwhile. During the past 2 years of work on this book, I kept encountering this deadly despair. Driving down a highway lined with gas stations, fast food restaurants, and dollar stores, I often got vertigo, forgetting for a moment if I was in Detroit or Kansas City or Cleveland. There are parts of the United States, including whole sections of former manufacturing centers such as Ohio, that resemble the developing world, with boarded up storefronts, dilapidated houses, pothole streets, and crumbling schools. The end of the world is no longer an abstraction to many Americans. We have turned our backs on the working class, with much of the worst assaults, such as NAFTA and welfare reform, which saw 1 million Americans thrown off of welfare rolls, pushed through during President Clinton's Democratic administration. We stand passively and watch an equally pernicious assault on the middle class. Anything that can be put on software, from architecture to engineering to finance, can be outsourced, handed to workers overseas, but will be paid a third of what their American counterparts receive, and who will, like some 47 million Americans, have no access to health insurance or benefits. There has been, along with the rise of an American oligarchy, a steady Weimarization of the American working class. The top 1% of American households now has more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. This figure alone should terrify all who care about our democracy. As Plutarch reminded us, An imbalance between the rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. The stories believers told me of their lives before they found Christ were heartbreaking. These chronicles were about terrible pain, severe financial difficulties, struggles with addictions, or childhood sexual or physical abuse, profound alienation, and often thoughts about suicide. They were chronicles without hope. The real world betrayed them. They hated this world. And they willingly walked out on this world for the mythical world offered by these radical preachers. A world of magic. A world where God had a divine plan for them and intervened on a daily basis to protect them and perform miracles in their lives. The rage many expressed to me towards those who challenged this belief system was a rage born of fear. The fear of being plunged back into a reality-based world where these magical props would no longer exist, where they would once again be adrift, abandoned, and alone. And these Americans, tens of millions of them, now lie locked in the hermetic, closed systems of indoctrination provided by Christian schools, Christian homeschooling, and Christian radio and television. They receive all of their news, health and beauty tips, entertainment, and spiritual guidance through this twisted ideological prism. Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism of this drive by all totalitarian movements to shut followers off from the real world. Before they seize power and establish a world according to their doctrines, she wrote, totalitarian movements conjure up a lying world of consistency, which is more adequate to the needs of the human mind than reality itself, in which, through sheer imagination, uprooted masses can feel at home and are spared the never-ending shocks which real life and real experiences deal to human beings and their expectations. The force possessed by totalitarian propaganda, before the movements have the power to drop iron curtains to prevent anyone's disturbing by the slightest reality the gruesome quiet of an entirely imaginary world, lies in its ability to shut the masses off from the real world. Dominionists now control most of America's major evangelical organizations, including nearly all Christian radio and television stations and denominations such as the Southern Baptist Convention. But Christians who challenge dominionists, even if they are fundamentalist or conservative or born again, are ruthlessly thrust aside. The marriage between these religious radicals and the neoconservatives who seek to further unfetter corporations and remove the federal government from the task of regulating industry or taking care of the poor has seen the movement make huge inroads into the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of American government. They stand poised to reshape and refashion American society. If they succeed, however, it will not be due to their ruthlessness and mendacity, or their callous manipulation of the people they lure into their movement, many of whom live on the margins of American society. It will be because of the moral failure of those who understand them, yet fail to confront them. The leading American institutions, tasked with defending tolerance and liberty, from the mainstream church to the great research universities to the Democratic Party to the press, have failed us. This is the awful paradox of tolerance. There arise moments when those who would destroy the tolerance that makes an open society possible can no longer be tolerated. They must be held accountable by those institutions tasked with maintaining the free exchange of ideas, mutual respect, liberty, and tolerance. They must be denied the right to demonize whole segments of American society as manipulated by Satan and worthy only of conversion or eradication. They must be made to treat their opponents with mutual respect and acknowledge the right of a fair hearing, even as they are free to disagree with their opponents. This passivity in the face of the Christian right threatens the health of the Republic. And the movement is picking off the last remaining obstacles to their systems of indoctrination, mounting a fierce campaign to defeat hate crimes legislation, knowing that the courts could apply it to them as they spew hate talk over the radio, television, and internet about immigrants, gays, lesbians, liberals, and all those they brand as secular humanists. Despotic movements harness the power of modern communications to keep their followers locked in these closed systems. If this long, steady poisoning of the civil discourse is not challenged, if this movement continues to teach neighbor to hate neighbor, eventually the civil society in America will collapse. The Christian broadcasters, along with Christian schools and colleges, are indoctrinating and inciting followers in the name of Christ and American values to tear apart the nation. They preach, in short, civil war. Karl Popper, in the first volume of The Enemies of the Open Society, writes of this paradox of tolerance. Unlimited tolerance, he says, must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance, even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies. As long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be most unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them, if necessary by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim in the name of tolerance the right not to tolerate the intolerant. We should claim that any movement preaching intolerance places itself outside the law. And we should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal. In the same way, we consider incitement to murder or kidnapping or the revival of the slave trade as criminal. The radical Christian right, these dominionists, have no religious legitimacy. This is a mass political movement. It ignores the core values of the Christian religion, summed up by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, and the core values of American democracy. They are, as the late Reverend William Sloan Coffin pointed out, not biblical literalists, as they claim, but selective literalists, choosing the bits and pieces of the Bible that conform to their ideology and ignoring, distorting, and making up the rest. The rapture, for example, the cornerstone of their end-time eschatology, is not in the Bible. There is enough hatred, bigotry, and lust for violence in the pages of the Bible to satisfy any tyrant bent on justifying cruelty and violence as being biblically sanctioned. Religion, as Reinhold Niebuhr knew, is a good thing for good people and a bad thing for bad people. But the suppositions of the biblical writers, who understood little about the working of the cosmos or the human body, are so fanciful and the accounts so wild that even biblical literalists reject them. God is not, as many writers of the Bible believed, peering down on us through little peepholes in the sky called stars. And the selective literalist cannot have it both ways. The Bible is either all true, an impossibility, given that it frequently is at odds with itself, and its most bizarre edicts must be obeyed, or it must be read in another way. Liberal Christians who can cherry-pick the Bible to create a Jesus and a God that is always loving and compassionate have to face the fact that there are also hateful passages in the Bible that bolster the rage, self-aggrandizement, and intolerance of the Christian right. These passages have been used to sanctify persecution in the past, whether during the murderous reign of the Emperor Constantine, the Inquisition, or the Salem witch trials. What is heretical is not that such passages exist, but that they are taken out of context and used to give sacred authority to hateful political and social creeds. Plato and Aristotle not only defended slavery, but often attacked Athenian democracy. But this does not mean that they should not be read for their penetrating insights into political systems and ethics. Sigmund Freud understood little about love, viewed religion as infantile regression, and colored nearly every human motive through the lens of human sexuality. But at the same time, Freud gave us one of the most powerful windows and vocabularies into the workings of our subconscious. The Bible was written by numerous people over hundreds of years with wide and often varying agendas, some of which were morally indefensible. But within its pages are powerful passages that help illuminate our lives and our place before the mysteries of human existence. The Bible, even with all its quirks and contradictions, its moments of madness and hatred, its mythologies of suns being halted in the skies, 90-year-old women giving birth, and men rising from the dead, informs my life. It is what led me to write this book. I too struggle, like the writers of the Bible, to understand. I too often get it wrong. But it is the honesty of the search, the doubts and the reverses, the mistakes and regrets, the effort to stand up and keep trying, that ultimately defines belief. It is not the certainty and self-righteousness, the tired and opaque cliche that Jesus is my personal Lord and Savior. This humility before the unknowable makes possible self-criticism, self-awareness, self-possession, and self-reflection. It makes possible a diverse human community. Dr. James Luther Adams, my ethics professor at Harvard Divinity School, told us that when we were his age, he was then close to 80, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. The warning given to me 25 years ago came at the moment Pat Robertson and other radio and televangelists began speaking about a new political religion that would direct its efforts at taking control of all institutions, including mainstream denominations and the government. Its stated goal was to use the United States to create a global Christian empire. It was hard at the time to take such fantastic rhetoric seriously, especially given the buffoonish quality of those who expounded it. But Adams warned us against the blindness caused by intellectual snobbery. The Nazis, he said, were not going to return with swastikas and brown shirts. Their ideological inheritors had found a mask for fascism in patriotism and the pages of the Bible. Adams was not a man to use the word fascist lightly. He was in Germany in 1935 and 1936 and worked with the underground anti-Nazi church known as the Confessing Church, led by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Adams was eventually detained and interrogated by the Gestapo, who suggested he might want to consider returning to the United States. It was a suggestion he followed. He left on a night train with framed portraits of Adolf Hitler placed over the contents inside his suitcase. To hide the rolls of home movie film, he took of the so-called German Christian Church, which was pro-Nazi, and the few individuals who defied them, including the theologians Karl Barth and Albert Schweitzer. The ruse worked when the border police lifted the top of the suitcases, saw the portraits of the Führer, and closed them up again. I watched hours of the grainy black and white films as he narrated in his apartment in Cambridge. Adams saw in the Christian right, long before we did, disturbing similarities with the German Christian Church and the Nazi Party. Similarities that he said would, in the event of prolonged social instability or a national crisis, see American fascists, under the guise of religion, rise to dismantle the open society. He despaired of liberals, who, he said, as in Nazi Germany, mouthed platitudes about dialogue and inclusiveness that made them ineffectual and impotent. Liberals, he said, did not understand the power and allure of evil, nor the cold reality of how the world worked. the hand-wringing by Democrats, with many asking how they can reach out to a movement whose leaders brand them as demonic and satanic, would not have surprised Adams. Like Bonhoeffer, he did not believe that those who would fight effectively in coming times of turmoil, a fight that for him was an integral part of the biblical message, would come from the church or the liberal secular elite. His critique of the prominent research universities, along with the media, was no less withering. These institutions, self-absorbed, compromised by their close relationship with government and corporations, given enough of the pie to be complacent, were unwilling to deal with the fundamental moral questions and inequities of the age. They had no stomach for a battle that might cost them their prestige and comfort. He told me, I suspect, half in jest, that if the Nazis took over America, 60% of the Harvard faculty would begin their lectures with a Nazi salute. But this, too, was not an abstraction. He had watched academics at the University of Heidelberg, including the philosopher Martin Heidegger, raise their arms stiffly to students before class. Adams also reminded us that American intellectuals and industrialists openly flirted with fascism in the 1930s. Mussolini's corporatism, which created an unchecked industrial and business aristocracy, appealed to many American industrialists at the time, who saw it as an effective counterweight to the New Deal. In 1934, Fortune magazine lavished praise on the Italian dictator for his defanging of labor unions and his empowerment of industrialists at the expense of workers. Adams finally told us to watch closely what the Christian right did to homosexuals. He had seen how the Nazis had used values to launch state repression of opponents. Hitler, days after he took power in 1933, imposed a ban on all homosexual organizations. He ordered raids on places where homosexuals gathered, culminating with the ransacking of the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin. Thousands of volumes from the Institute's library were tossed that May into a bonfire. Adams said that homosexuals would be the first deviants singled out by the Christian right. We would be the next. The ban on same-sex marriages passed by 11 states was part of this march towards our door. A 1996 federal law already defines marriage as between a man and a woman. All of the states with ballot measures, with the exception of Oregon, had already outlawed same-sex marriages, as do 27 other states. The bans, however, had to be passed. Believers were told to thwart activist judges who wanted to overturn them. The Christian family, even the nation, was under threat. The ban served to widen the splits tearing apart the country. The attacks on homosexuals handed to the foot soldiers of the Christian right an easy, vulnerable target. It gave them a taste of victory. It made them feel empowered. But it is ominous for gays and for us. 2 decades later, even in the face of the growing reach of the Christian right, Adams' prediction seems apocalyptic. And yet the power brokers in the Christian right have moved from the fringes of society to the executive branch, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the courts. The movement has all but seized control of the Republican Party. 45 senators and 186 members of the House of Representatives earned between an 80 to 100% approval rating from the 3 most influential Christian right advocacy groups, the Christian Coalition, Eagle Forum, and Family Resource Council. And the radical Christian right is seeking to take control of military chaplaincies, which now sees them holding roughly 50% of chaplaincy appointments in the armed services and the service academies. This is part of a much larger effort to politicize the military and law enforcement. This effort signals the final and perhaps most deadly stage in a long campaign by the radical Christian right to dismantle America's open society and build a theocratic state. A successful politicization of the military would signal the end of our democracy. During the past 2 years, I repeatedly listened to radical preachers attack as corrupt and godless most American institutions, from federal agencies that provide housing and social welfare to public schools and the media. But there were 2 institutions that never came under attack: the military and law enforcement. While these preachers had no interest in communicating with local leaders of other faiths or those in the community who did not subscribe to their call for a radical Christian state, they assiduously courted and flattered the military and police. They held special services and appreciation days for all four branches of the armed services and for various law enforcement agencies. They encouraged their young men and women to enlist or to join the police or state troopers. They sought out sympathetic military and police officials to attend church events, where these officials were lauded and feted for their Christian probity and patriotism. They painted the war in Iraq not as an occupation, but as an apocalyptic battle by Christians against Islam, a religion they regularly branded as satanic. All this befits a movement whose final aesthetic is violence. It also befits a movement that in the end would need the military and police to hold power in American society. The movement is building a Praetorian Guard, referring to the paramilitary force that defied legal constraints, made violence part of the political discourse, and eventually plunged ancient Rome into tyranny and despotism. They need a paramilitary force that operates outside the law, one that sows fear among potential opponents and is capable of physically silencing those branded by their leaders as traitors. It is a vital instrument in the hands of despotic movements, communist and fascist movements during the last century, each built paramilitary forces that operated beyond the reach of the law. Eric Prince, the secretive mega-millionaire, right-wing Christian founder of Blackwater, the private security firm that has built a formidable mercenary force in Iraq, champions his company as a patriotic extension of the U.S. military. His employees, in an act as cynical as it is deceitful, take an oath of loyalty to the Constitution. These mercenary units in Iraq, including Blackwater, contain some 25,000 fighters. They unleash indiscriminate and wanton violence against unarmed Iraqis and are beyond the reach of legitimate authority. The appearance of these paramilitary fighters, heavily armed and wearing their trademark black uniforms, patrolling the streets of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, gave us a grim taste of the future. It was a stark reminder that the tyranny we impose on others, we will one day impose on ourselves. The politicization of the military, the fostering of the belief that violence must be used to further a peculiar ideology rather than defend a democracy, was on display recently when Air Force and Army generals and colonels filmed in uniform at the Pentagon appeared in a promotional video distributed by Christian Embassy, a radical Washington-based organization dedicated to building a Christian America. Dan Cooper, an Undersecretary of Veterans Affairs, says in the video that his weekly prayer sessions are more important than doing the job. Major General Jack Catton says that his being an advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff is a wonderful opportunity to evangelize men and women setting defense policy. My first priority is my faith, he says. I think it's a huge impact. You have many men and women who are seeking God's counsel and wisdom as they advise the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense. The group has burrowed deep inside the Pentagon. It hosts weekly Bible sessions with senior officers, by its own count, some 40 generals, and weekly prayer breakfast each Wednesday from 7 to 7:50 a.m. in the executive dining room, as well as numerous outreach events, in the words of the organization, to share and sharpen one another in their quest to bridge the gap between faith and work. If the United States falls into a period of instability caused by another catastrophic terrorist attack, an economic meltdown, or a series of environmental disasters, these paramilitary forces, protected and assisted by fellow ideologues in the police and military, could swiftly abolish what is left of our eroding democracy. War with the huge profits it hands to businesses and right-wing interests that often help bankroll the Christian right could become a permanent condition. And the thugs with automatic weapons, black uniforms, and wraparound sunglasses who appeared on the streets in New Orleans could appear on our streets. In a moment of crisis, I expect a popular backlash, but it will, I fear, be a right-wing backlash. a frightened and enraged populace could turn to the very forces that have orchestrated this desperation and ask them to save them. The radical Christian right calls for exclusion, cruelty, and intolerance in the name of God. Its members do not commit evil for evil's sake. They commit evil to make a better world. To attain this better world, they believe some must suffer and be silenced. And at the end of time, all those who oppose them must be destroyed. The worst human suffering in history has been carried out by those who preach such grand utopian visions, those who seek to implant by force their narrow, particular goodness. This is true for all doctrines of personal salvation, from Christianity to ethnic nationalism to communism to fascism. Dreams of a universal good create hells of persecution, suffering, and slaughter. No human being could ever be virtuous enough to attain such dreams, and the earth has swallowed millions of hapless victims in the vain pursuit of a new heaven and a new earth. Ironically, it is idealism that leads radical fundamentalists to strip human beings of their dignity and their sanctity and turn them into abstractions. Yet it is only by holding on to the sanctity of each individual, each human life, only by placing our faith in tiny, unheroic acts of compassion and kindness that we survive as a community and as individual human beings. Hope has two beautiful daughters, Augustine wrote. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. Anger, when directed against those who would abuse the weak, preach bigotry and injustice, trample on the poor, crush dissent, and impose a religious tyranny, is a blessing. Read the prophets. But because so many of our institutions are bankrupt, bought off by corporate dollars, and no longer willing to accept in religious terms that heretics exist, the goal is to appease the very people who call for our destruction. The liberal church stumbles along, muttering creeds it no longer believes, trying to peddle a fuzzy, feel-good theology that distorts and ignores the Bible as much as the Christian right. The Christian right, at least, understands the ills of American society, even as they use these ills to plunge us into tyranny. The most potent opposition to the movement will rise, I expect, from within the evangelical tradition. And the movement fears Christians who have remained loyal to the core values of the gospel, who delineate between right and wrong, who are willing to be vilified and attacked in the name of a higher good, and who have the courage to fight back. We must begin to support those isolated groups and individuals who at some cost are fighting back, the clergy and rabbis who have banded together in Ohio to challenge in court the tax-exempt status of the megachurches that peddle this ideology and promote Christian candidates. The independent judges, such as the Republican-appointed judge in Dover, Pennsylvania, who banned the teaching of creationism in the public school because it is mythology, not science. As well as Cardinal Roger Mahoney, the head of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, the nation's largest, who called on Catholics to be prepared to defy current efforts in Congress, backed by the Christian right, to make it a felony to shield or protect or offer support to illegal immigrants. The bill before Congress would expand the definition of alien smuggling to theoretically include working in a soup kitchen, driving a friend to a bus stop, or caring for a neighbor's child. It would make mercy, compassion, and charity for the least among us a federal crime. There are two solutions left. We can begin to fight the corporate state to redirect our national wealth and resources to fund a massive anti-poverty campaign and curb the cycle of perpetual war that enriches the military-industrial complex and, by extension, the two political parties that dominate Washington. Or we can accept an inevitable Christo-fascism backed by these corporations. Don't expect glib democratic politicians to address these issues. They are, as Ralph Nader understands, hostage to corporate money. George Bush is the worst president in American history. If Al Gore or John Kerry had the spine to take him on, to challenge corporate welfare, corporate crime, the hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate bailouts, and issues such as labor law reform, if either had actually stood up to these corporate behemoths on behalf of the working and middle class, rather than mutter thought-terminating cliches about American greatness, they could have won in a landslide. But they did not dare to piss off their corporate paymasters. These corporations and their enraged and manipulated followers in the Christian right, tens of millions of them, if left unchecked, will propel us into despotism. The corporate state has rigged our system, hollowed out our political process, and steadily stripped citizens of constitutional rights, federal and state protection and assistance. It is a coup d'etat in slow motion. Edward Luttwak, the conservative historian, says that if current trends continue, the United States will be a third world country by 2020. This may be the twilight of American democracy. And it is better to stand up and fight, even in vain, than not to fight at all. Any support for a political candidate unwilling to challenge the corporate state is a wasted vote, even if this means to opt out of the two-party system. In Mark Twain's book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, it ends with Huck facing the moral dilemma we face, whether to pay homage to a false moral and legal code or damn ourselves in the eyes of many by opposing it. So I was full of trouble, full as I could be, and didn't know what to do. At last I had an idea and I says, I'll go and write the letter and then see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing, the way I felt as light as a feather right straight off, and my troubles all gone. So I got a piece of paper and a pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, Miss Watson, your runaway Negro Jim is down here 2 mile below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him and will give him up for the reward if you send. Huck Finn. I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking. Thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And went on thinking. And got to thinking over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms. And we a floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n, instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping, and see him how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to him again in the swamp up there where the feud was and such like times, and would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard. And he was so grateful and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was a-trembling because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. I do not deny the right of these Christian radicals to believe and worship as they choose. But I will not engage in a dialogue with those who deny my right to be, who delegitimize my faith and denounce my struggle before God as worthless. All dialogue must include respect and tolerance for the belief, worth, and dignity of others, including those outside the nation and the faith. When this respect is denied, it is no longer a difference of opinion. It is a fight for survival. This movement seeks, in the name of Christianity and American democracy, to destroy that which it claims to defend. I do not believe that America will inevitably become a fascist state, or that the Christian right is the Nazi party. But I do believe that the Christian right is a sworn and potent enemy of the open society. Its ideology bears within it the seeds of a religious fascism. In the event of a crisis, the movement stands poised to ruthlessly reshape America in ways that have not been seen since the nation's founding. All Americans, not only those of faith, must learn to speak about this movement with a new vocabulary, to give up passivity, and to defend tolerance. The attacks by this movement on the rights and beliefs of Muslims, Jews, immigrants, gays, lesbians, women, scholars, scientists, those they dismiss as nominal Christians, and those they brand with a curse of secular humanist, is an attack on all of us, on our values, our religious freedoms, and our democracy. Tolerance is a virtue, but tolerance, coupled with passivity, is a vice. Thank you.
Start by assuring you that I won't take 50 minutes. And I'm not taking anything away from Mr. Hedges because I happen to agree with what he said, in spite of the fact that he's a liberal. When I was introduced, you noticed Dr. Leonard said that I was an Air Force officer, and I had a reason for including that other than an attempt to make you feel sorry for me.
Will you try to stand a little closer to the mic?
Okay. Okay. About 3.5 years ago, I was reading articles about the Air Force officers at the Air Force Academy who were engaged in Christian proselytizing with the cadets. Now, where I come from, that's called a power differential. And at least in the case of university professors, I can't put my students in jail. But if I'm an Air Force officer at the academy, I can. And I got irritated. And coming from the South, of course, I expressed my irritation. I wrote a letter to the brand new superintendent of the academy basically saying, you are a worthless pissant, a disgrace to the uniform, and you ought to resign. And I got a reply. And the reply said, give me a break. I just started. I've only been here 6 weeks. Give me a chance to fix this problem. Now 3 years have gone by. And guess what? The problem hasn't been solved. I believe the political class called that pushback. I call that cave-in. So that's the influence at our military academies that my brethren from the Southern Baptist religion and likewise thinking people have, that they can actually take something which is flat against their oath of office, because you do remember that that Constitution that we all took to defend and protect does call for this funny thing called separation of church and state. Odd how that works. So anyway, I decided I wasn't going to write another letter to this poor guy, because after 3 years, he's probably found something else to do, like retire. But in any case, the book that my friend and co-author Stephen Fortney and I have written doesn't have the same message as Mr. Hedges' book, there are a great number of similarities. The job that Stephen and I gave ourselves was basically two parts. First, are science and religion compatible? Because as you know, most people say that it's like football. You have the good, the Green Bay Packers, the bad, the Chicago Bears, and the ugly, the Dallas Cowboys. I'm quoting a recent sweater that I saw one of my friends wearing. Anyway, we didn't see it that way, and we don't see it that way. And the book that we've written provides arguments that say that there are, in fact, two types of truth-seeking, at least, but two main types. One is we call science, one we call religion, and they're compatible. They're complementary. That's a little different from some of the books that you may have heard, especially by the people who like this team sport analogy stuff. The other part is, in fact, the subtitle of our book, Living with Doubt. Now that's the part where we came very close to what Mr. Hedges has been talking about. Because if you do not doubt, how can you be sure of your faith? Because if you're simply accepting, it's not faith, it's indoctrination. By any name, it's still indoctrination. And so in the 12 chapters of our book, and just between us and the FBI's bug in the wall, that would be for the 12 Christian apostles, of course, can't resist. We ask questions like doubt and wasteland and individual journey and freedom, and we try to reconcile science and religion, or at least confuse the issue enough that you think we have. But with all my southern sort of humor aside, there is one thing that we do talk about that bears very closely on what Mr. Hedges has just discussed. And that can be summed up in one word. The word is gumption. In the last chapter of our book, which we entitle Hope, we ask the question, is there hope? And we say, yes, maybe. Good Midwesterners, you don't want to be definite. Anyway, we do, however, say that, just as Mr. Hedges has said, that the research universities and the scientists who do the work they do, they need to stop ignoring. So do we all, in fact. And for that, you need gumption. Because remember, we don't have to do what Dieter Bonhoeffer did. Dieter Bonhoeffer, for those of you who don't know, was a minister. He left Germany when the Nazis took over, shortly after. And he came back to Nazi Germany to fight against the Nazis and died in the death camps for his trouble. No, we don't have to do that. But we do have to have enough courage to speak out against the people who would basically turn freedom into irrationality, into a wasteland, indeed, as we talk about in our book. And I don't have a whole lot more to add, and I will certainly spare you any more southern humor. So thank you for your time.
Before I open up the floor for questions for either of our speakers, I'm wondering if Chris or Marshall, if you would like to have any conversation among yourselves. Are there things that you'd like further elaboration on?
I think we can open it up.
Yeah, I think opening it up would make sense, given the off time and all.
Well, then the floor is open. Yes, sir, please stand and speak loudly so the whole assembly can hear.
Early on, you spoke of are being saved by faith. I'm wondering, what do you mean by saved?
Do you hear the question?
You need to turn it on.
Oh.
Can you hear the question?
Yeah.
He asked early on, I spoke of being saved by faith. What did I mean by that?
I think anyone who makes a realistic appraisal of our situation in the world right now has to admit that it's very bleak. The destruction of the ecosystem, the massive overpopulation of the planet, the wars that have already begun to be fought over dwindling natural resources, means that we're headed for a period of difficulty and probably immense human tragedy. And I think that many of us look around at the deterioration that is going on not only within the country but around us and feel overwhelmed and unable to do anything. And I think that that is where faith comes in. You know, it was, I covered for two decades some of the worst conflicts around the globe, including the wars in Central America, the Balkans. And the Serbs or the Salvadorans would go into a village, massacre a dozen, two dozen people, often women and children, and then cut the roads so that it couldn't be reported. There was no access. Our job as war correspondents and photographers was to walk in at some danger, record the atrocities that had been taken place, and to publish those, that information in the paper, get it onto a television screen. Now, that didn't mean that we wouldn't wake up the next day and find the same thing had happened. And I think that when you're overwhelmed by that kind of violence and cruelty, it becomes very dangerous to say, well, nothing will change and it doesn't matter, and to adopt a kind of cynicism. I think that real spirituality for me is, and Bonhoeffer writes about this, is not this sort of narcissistic navel-gazing of, you know, how is it with me? But real spirituality is the spirituality of resistance. It is standing up and affirming something, even in the face of an absurdity, that is worth affirming. And I think in that sense, one is saved by faith, not a belief that we're God. Maybe by the end of our life, everything we fought for, stood for, and cared for has deteriorated and the situation is worse. But to have a belief that it's worth fighting for, even in the face of empirical evidence that it's hopeless and that it's getting worse. And I think that's where faith comes in, and that's where faith saves you.
Marshall would also like to reply.
I certainly agree with the faith part, but I also, since my education and my training and experiences in physics and the sciences, I believe that we can solve problems. So another part of this passivity idea, which I reject out of hand, is, in essence, I cannot take care of myself. I have to have somebody take care of me for me. I don't buy that for a minute. And I simply don't buy the idea that we as a society, as a community, lack the knowledge and the willingness to solve problems in ways that at least make things better if they're not panaceas. So I think that one other part is to solve problems, and I think that that can be done.
Yes, please.
Mr. Hedges, I agree a lot with you, and I got a lot out of your book on this subject. I agree mostly. But I'm trying to get a little perspective on this. Before I came over tonight, I read the article from the New York Times Sunday magazine a week ago Sunday called The Evangelical Crack-Up by David Kirkpatrick. Long article talking about the decline of the interest and activism around political themes in the evangelical community, as well as a rise, particularly in the under 30s, of a new form of the social gospel, kind of a conservative social gospel movement. And as a pastor, I serve many conservative churches in Wisconsin, though I never served up in central Wisconsin where the Posse Comitatus reigns. And I heard about churches or individuals who were Dominionist types, but I never ran across many. I'm a Methodist, so I'm a mainliner. But these were conservative churches. I found mainly people seeking comfort and indifferent to most of these things. On the other hand, you mentioned the CEO of Blackwater, and in some commentary on the news, he was identified as a Christian Dominionist, and how that was the central ideology of his operation. And a couple of weeks ago, I listened to Mike Huckabee's speech to the Christian right as they were trying to fight a candidate. And behind his comfortable Baptist preacher, Southern humor type of approach, I heard a
better than mine.
I heard a lot of Dominionist themes. So I'm trying to get a sociological perspective on the proportion of
That's a really
in relation to the total.
It's a really important point, and it is something that I do address at the beginning of the book, where I talk about, you know, the hardcore Dominionist in terms of percentages within the evangelical fundamentalist community in the United States is probably 7% or less. It's small. But when you go back and study revolutionary movements, they're always highly skilled, highly disciplined, highly funded, and very and represent a tiny minority. One thinks, for instance, of the Bolsheviks, 1% of the Russian population at most. But what they can do, they speak in a language which is comforting and reassuring to a huge segment of the population. You as a minister know very well the way they have distorted all sorts of traditional Christian themes of concepts. I mean, I list, you know, I go into some detail in the book, but I mean, just for instance, the notion of liberty. They use the word liberty. Bush uses it all the time. He has an evangelical speechwriter, inserts it for him into his text. And liberty is a word that all of us in this room probably have a kind of common consensus in understanding what it is and what it's about. If you come out of this segment of the religious population, the only real liberty, true liberty, is submission to Jesus Christ, and complete submission to Jesus. And, of course, that means submission to those who purport to speak for Jesus Christ. All other liberty is false liberty. Anyone ever read Klemperer's book, I Shall Bear Witness? It's a fascinating book because it's the first literary critique of National Socialism. Klemperer was a professor, Jewish, Leipzig, lost his university post early on, and set about deconstructing Nazi language. Primarily. And I think you have to deconstruct the language of this movement because they use words that are reassuring to most of us and to certainly those people within the movement, but they've been hollowed out to mean something different. So while the percentage of hardcore Dominionists is tiny, they can count on the sympathy of tens of millions of Americans. Because they're speaking in a language which is reassuring to them. Although, of course, many of these words are, it's a kind of newspeak quality, and that they are almost diametrically opposed in meaning as to what is accepted conventionally. There's a powerful book by a historian called Claudia Kunz called The Nazi Conscience, in which she looks at the first years of the Nazi regime. And she talks about how the ascendancy of the Nazi Party was built because they were essentially going to restore moral values. It was about moral purity. And that Hitler apparently, between 1933 when he took power and 1938, only mentioned the Jews three times. Because the raw anti-Semitism just didn't go down among the larger German public. And many of the fringe elements within the Nazi Party accused Hitler of betraying them. And of being cowed by the internationally organized Jewish boycott of German goods. And I think that the Christian right is doing a very similar thing. So it is a tiny percentage, but that doesn't mean that it's not exceedingly dangerous.
Let me tell you a story. Stephen Fortney and I had a book signing in McFarland about 3 weeks ago. There was a pastor from Stoughton who shall, for reasons of libel, remain nameless. We can talk privately. And he was apparently very impressed with me, not with my co-author, but with me, the non-religious part of the team, as it were. So he sent me a DVD, which I still have, and he asked me, would I look at it and give him some feedback? And it was a DVD which he made with a man who runs a creation science group in Milwaukee, in Waukesha, and which was an hour-long conversation about two main topics, those being evolution and cosmology. Evolution I know something about because we included it in our book, and so I learned. Cosmology I know something about because it's part of physics. So I gave him some feedback, and it ran to 4.5 typewritten single-spaced pages and 18 items. And those were the ones that came to mind. Those statements included outright lies, half-truths, character assassination of people who didn't see things the way the guest did. Sounds like the Dominionist to me in terms of tactics. There are tactics that anyone who gets into politics, for example, knows all about, or they get out of politics. But the fact is, that's what's going on. So a person who doesn't know any better, a 10-year-old grandkid, goes to a church, gets this in their Bible study class. This is what you're going to read here today, an hour-long DVD, like a movie. And they would. Obviously, the 10-year-old won't know about evolution, won't know about cosmology, won't know about modern physics or biology. Why wouldn't that 10-year-old accept what these authority figures are telling him or her is in fact the case?
You have a $25 million creation museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, which I visited. You go in and see a recreation of the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve naked but discreetly positioned in a waterfall so you can't see her breasts or anything, with dinosaurs with saddles on them, because of course the dinosaurs were created at the same time as everyone and all the other, but they wouldn't harm people because it was peaceable. But then the thorny question of T-Rex's teeth came up, and the guide explained to us that T-Rex had such big teeth to crack open the coconuts for Adam and Eve. And then we went on and saw a recreation of Noah's Ark. And of course, the natural question is, how did Noah get the dinosaurs on the Ark? And Noah got the dinosaurs on the Ark because he only put baby dinosaurs on the Ark. You walk out of there and it's... you don't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, the functional absurdity of it. I went to a creationist seminar in Missouri where they were giving lessons on Christian school teachers how to teach creation. And how do you deal with the fact that God created light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day? And the instructor said, well, you tell the children that God created a temporary light for 4 days. Well, there's nothing in Genesis that indicates that God created a temporary light. And it's in those kinds of details that you realize how irrational and frightening this belief system is. And how, as I said earlier, in quoting Hannah Arendt, these people have been removed from a reality-based world. And unless you pull them back into a reality-based world, you're not going to argue them out of their belief, because the foundational aspects of their belief are not based on truth or logic. They're based on a need for emotional and psychological certitude.
The woman over here.
I wanted to ask about unwanted tolerance facilities and how that leads to intolerance. And I was thinking about how it seems like I see a lot of, you know, what you call it, other than learned powerlessness on the part of so many of us who are not on Christian Rites, who have kind of learned that we can't do a thing about it. You know what I mean? We can't. Corporations have taken over and we can't do a thing, as if we've all been separated. And what needs to happen for us to reclaim our power? In a nice way, seize control.
Well, that's a really important question. Because I think the corporation, I mean, look, citizens have one institution in a democratic state that represents their interest, and that is the government, however ineffectual and incompetent it can be. The government has been seized by the corporations. I mean, there was a front page story on today's New York Times about how the head of the regulatory agency that oversees the safety of products doesn't want an increase in the budget. You know, and this started, you know, with Reagan, but what was furthered by the Clinton administration, every single governmental department is run by corporations. You know, even under the Clinton administration, the Department of Labor was not handed over to, in a democratic administration, to a representative of the labor community. So I voted for Ralph Nader. I'm not going to support. I believe that the corporate state is ultimately the issue. You know, we used to, if we all are, those of us who are old enough to remember, think back 20, 30 years, people like Proxmire and others, they used to question absurd expenditures for weapons systems and $27 billion Trident submarines and waste and fraud, and nobody questions anything anymore. If we don't break the back of the corporate state, we're doomed, because what they have done, or and what they're doing, is essentially creating an oligarchic state, a kind of global serfdom, where you have a managerial elite, and roughly two-thirds of the country live in impoverished. So I would say stepping outside of the two-party system is good. You're very right to point out that we're isolated. I mean, we live in a society that has become so fragmented and so alienated that the only communication we often have with the other is virtual, which isn't really communication. You know, I think that that destruction of community and that sense of isolation, which I think all of us feel, has been a powerful tool in the hands of those who seek to disempower us. I also, you know, and I was talking with Marshall about this, I think that I'm a writer, you know, and I write regularly, and if anyone reads Common Dreams and Truth Out and Alternate, you know, this stuff, they'll see my stuff for The Nation. I just wrote a piece for The Nation, I think it's coming out next week, that if we go to war with Iran, I will stop paying my income taxes. I think that we have to, you know, it may be futile, but I think we have to begin to make personal decisions about what we're going to do. And I'm not saying everyone shouldn't pay their income tax. Everyone has to make that decision for themselves, what it is. But we have to begin to be proactive instead of standing around saying, why aren't there crowds of people on the street? Why don't people demonstrate? I think we have to stop asking those questions, and I think we have to turn inward, and we have to say, what am I going to do? Even if it's futile, even if it doesn't change anything, what am I going to do to try and stick a spoke in the wheel? What kind of sacrifices am I going to make to try and halt this frightening slide towards a police state? And that's really what we're sliding towards.
Well,
I don't have a whole lot to add. The things that occur to me are basically to realize that the institutions that individuals can control are primarily through their members of, in this case, congressional representative and U.S. senators. Well, even though I'm a political conservative, I kind of admire Russell Feingold because he is willing to do things. So speaking hypothetically, I would imagine if 5,000 people went into Ms. Baldwin and said, we're going to each spend $1,000 to unelect you if you don't initiate impeachment proceedings in the House of Representatives, which is where such proceedings are initiated. $5 million makes a hell of a war chest for somebody. And that's just a hypothetical. That's an example to me where people could sacrifice but not financially ruin themselves and do something. But I think the problem is to realize what people were dealing with. One of the last people who worked with Senator Barry Goldwater before he died quite frequently has quoted Goldwater as saying, regarding the Christian concert right, I can't deal with these people. They don't compromise. We have to do everything they want or we're going to hell. And of course, Goldwater was not known for being calm and dispassionate in his expression. And those are the people that are being dealt with here. That's just the way it is.
And somebody from the back. From the back, please. Yes.
Mr. Hedges, I've got a few minutes questions that will probably be considered opinions. So
can you speak louder, please?
Okay. I've had some business partners who would be considered dominionists. And so I understand how skewed the mindset is. But my question is, part of your thesis is that the base for that movement is formed from the essentially despair of the working class. And given that the leaders of that movement are very affluent by and large, I mean, none of them have taken also into poverty. My question is, at what point, well, the political agenda of the movement is almost a classist agenda, and it does not support the working class by and large, it supports the very affluent. And at what point does the self-interest of the individual bump up against the agenda of the movement?
That's a really good question. Did everyone hear that?
No.
And he's saying that the leaders of this movement are personally wealthy, and they don't represent the interests of the working class. And at what point is there a clash between the leaders and the working class? I would argue there isn't one. The reason is this. The Democratic Party betrayed the working class in this country, especially under the administration of Bill Clinton. That's what NAFTA did. That's what welfare reform did. And Thomas Franks wrote that book, What's the Matter of Camus, which is a great book and worth reading. But he asked the question, how can these people vote against their interests? Well, they're not voting against their interests. The rage towards liberals on the part of the working class is not misplaced. It's a rational response to betrayal. The Democratic Party, until the Clinton administration, looked out for the interests of its members, which were rank and file working class people, many from my own family. And Clinton understood that the corporations were quite willing to fund the Democratic Party. We have a memo from Clinton in the late 1980s explaining this to the Democratic leadership, that the working class was going to vote for the Democratic Party anyway. And by the 1990s, the Democrats had reached fundraising parity with the Republicans. And then we see in the current campaign, in fact, the Democrats are getting more money than the Republicans. And so the working class has nowhere to go because both political parties have sold them out.
And all they have left is to become embraced in this movement. Now, what is this movement, this non-reality-based belief movement, tell them? It tells them that if you have enough faith and you believe in Jesus, he'll take care of you financially. Watch Pat Robertson. You know, I was, you know, drinking too much, and then I found Jesus, and now look at my Cadillac. I mean, it's that crude. That Jesus will heal you. You don't need health insurance, because if you're right with Jesus, you know, and Pat will sit there on the screen and put his hands to his temple and go, I see a woman in a red sweater, and she has back pains, and the Holy Spirit, you know. And so it is really a very cruel manipulation and abuse of tremendous personal despair. I don't think we will break the back of this movement until we re-enfranchise these people back into the American system. I think that, you know, that's why you have large corporations like Walmart, Sam's Club, others, that are putting these Dominionist chaplains in their warehouses and factories to proselytize to their workers. Because, you know, it is, you know, steal a line from Marx, this kind of religion is an opiate. It allows people to essentially advocate in a kind of cruel twist of fate for their own enslavement.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just got two real quick questions. I'm about the least religious guy you could meet, but I always hear people saying the Bible is meant to be taken, much of it, as parables, you know, just transcendental thinking. How do we know what these people meant when they wrote it? How do we know that it was or wasn't supposed to be taken literally? How do we know that? And number two, isn't much of this religious fundamentalism a reaction to discussions that people just weren't having 30, 40 years ago, like the issues of homosexuality? I graduated high school in 1990, and it wasn't even really a topic that even came up. You know, you never even heard about it amongst youth. I mean, these seem to be kind of new discussions where 30, 40 years ago, you didn't even have the people who had conservative values didn't feel the need to bring it up. I mean, it was a no-brainer, you know, that this wasn't even discussed.
Well, he's asking, how do you know the intent of the writers of the Bible? There were so many writers in the Bible. Many of them had, you know, the intents were very different. Even within the four Gospels, the intents were different. And you have to place, you know, the Hebrew Bible was written over a span of several hundred years. Many of those passages were responding to specific historical events. For instance, the book of Revelation was responding to the despotism of Nero. And the call for, you know, when these sort of bloody passages are talking about the, you know, that apocalyptic moment when Christians rise up and defeat the Roman Empire. I mean, so there is no uniform vision in the part of the Bible, because first of all, it was never a book. It was, you know, the word is ta biblia. It means little books, and it was only made into a book in the 3rd century. If you wanted to read the Bible, you went into a bookseller shop, and there were little wooden boxes with a series of scrolls. Some of them had wisdom literature, some of them had, you know, history, some of them had psalms, some of them had aphorisms. You know, and there was no order. I mean, the order was imposed later. So the Bible, when it was written, was never meant to be coherent. I mean, look at the book of Ecclesiastes, which is beautiful. I mean, it could have been written by Samuel Beckett. It's about a morally neutral universe. It's about despair. It's about how everything is vanity. It's about, you know, so you find, you know, widely divergent views in the Bible when you read it carefully. There is no uniform. I mean, of course, the Christian fundamentalists will claim that there is, but there isn't. And they only can claim that by ignoring huge sections of the Bible. And one of the most interesting things about interviewing all these people is how biblically ignorant they are. When you really get, I mean, you know, having been raised in the church and graduated from seminary, they don't actually know the Bible very well. They have the Bible, bits and pieces of the Bible fed to them, but they don't actually know the Bible. And your other question about...
a reaction to discussions we just weren't having 30, 40 years ago.
A reaction to... Well, I think Karen Armstrong makes a very important point, that the fundamentalist movements, and she writes about, she's a really great writer. I just, you know, admire all of her work. But she writes in The Battle for God, which is on Jewish, Christian, Islamic, and Hindu fundamentalism, that these are not traditional movements, they're distinctly modern movements. And I think she's right, not only in the way that they harness mass communications, but in the way that they seek to legitimize themselves, not through their religious texts, as they claim, but through pseudoscience. You know, that's why you have creationism. That's what creationism is. It's like eugenics. It's a pseudoscience meant to legitimize the creation myth in Genesis, because they know that their followers are not going to be convinced unless they can marshal scientific jargon and distort scientific facts to justify the creation myth. So I think that when you start breaking down these movements, although they talk about traditional values, and although they talk about reaching back to a lost mythical period of American history in a Christian nation, they are distinctly modern in their outlook, and part of that, of course, is their obsession with violence. With violence as a cleansing agent, kind of purging agent to purify the world and essentially destroy the world that they hate. I mean, this is really a movement about death. It's a movement about hatred. This world around them, they believe, tried to destroy them. And the greatest endpoint of human history, the greatest and most glorious moment, in their eyes, is the physical destruction of the planet and everybody on the planet who does not submit to their authority. That's what they celebrate constantly.
We've already gone beyond time, and I'm wondering if there would be a question that deals with science in particular. If not, we'll take one last question. Is there a science question?
Say, you know, the Constitution prohibits religious tests, and in that one Democratic debate, they asked all the candidates if they believed in evolution. I think it'd be nice to have a scientific test for holding office.
Can you repeat the question, please?
It was a comment that said we're not allowed to ask candidates, or candidates don't have to have a religious litmus test, but perhaps we should ask political candidates whether or not they should pass a science test, such as, do you believe in evolution? So I will take the question in the back, because you were standing and waving your arm since the beginning, so please.
Yeah. Economics and science. A question about Paul Krugman's book, The Great Unraveling, where in the preface he cites Henry Kissinger's thesis, dissertation, I guess, that talks about a period in Germany after the Napoleonic Wars where a revolutionary movement took over, and how the virus keeps yielding to the revolutionaries, and it's very much like the period today. And I wonder if you discussed this with Paul Krugman, as your ideas and his in that regard.
I had dinner with Krugman about a year ago. And I think on this issue we're completely in sync, that if you look back on the last few decades, for those of us who care about an open, tolerant, pluralistic, democratic society, we have just taken one step backwards after another. And I think Ralph Nader asked the right question. At what point do you stand up and say, I'm tired of voting for the least worst? Because it's not a deal you're going to win. The game of politics is about power. It's not about morality. And the only thing people in power understand is power. And the only power we have is to walk away from them. Until we are willing to do that, we're not going to bring pressure on them to change. I mean, the 2000 campaign by Nader freaked the Democrats out. You know, Nader wanted to hold a rally in Madison Square Garden. He didn't have any money. So he rented the garden and took a gamble. And he charged everyone who came to the rally $5 at the door, and he paid for the garden. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to self-selected candidates in the Democratic Party, you can imagine how they responded to this. And they started in 2000 and worked to destroy Nader. And they have destroyed Nader. And it's the Democrats and largely the Clintons who destroyed Nader. Because there was a groundswell in not 2004, but in 2000. And that frightened them. And until that groundswell comes back, we're going to be sheared like sheep. There's a wonderful line by the great rabbi Abraham Heschel, who got in trouble with his colleagues at Jewish Theological Seminary when he walked with Martin Luther King on the Sabbath, and they condemned him, and he told them, "I pray with my feet." Thanks.
Thank you very much, and I hope to see you here next week.